It is Monday, July the 30th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you here. Coming up, questions about former leader Robert Mugabe's influence as Zimbabwe votes.
The extent to which Mr. Mugabe still has influence over the electorate.
U.S. putting pressure on Turkey to release detained American pastor.
It makes it very hard for the Turks to actually release this guy unless they want to look like they're totally dancing to the tune of Washington.
Also ahead, Cambodia's election, plus a little something from the world of music. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Zimbabwe holds its first general election without its founding leader, 94-year-old Robert Mugabe, on the ballot today. Mugabe came to power in 1980, taking the oath as Zimbabwe's first leader after independence. He was to be the country's head until November last year, when military pressure led him to resign. Until his sudden address to reporters on Sunday, Mugabe had largely been quiet about the election, except in March when he said his successor, Emmerson Mnangagwa, had taken power through a coup. Mnangagwa is on today's ballot representing the ZANU-PF party. The election has effectively come down to a two-man contest, with Mnangagwa facing stiff competition from the new head of the largest opposition party, Nelson Chamisa. On Sunday, Robert Mugabe expressed his distaste with many of the choices on the ballot and the ZANU-PF party, which he formed in the 1960s.
I can't vote for ZANU-PF. I can't vote for those who have caused me to be in this condition. I have also said Maim Juru and my coupe don't offer very much. So there is Chamisa left.
VOA's Victor Beatty asked John Campbell, Senior Fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, what he makes of Mugabe's comments.
I think Mr. Mugabe deeply resents the fact that he has been set aside. Now, what I don't know, and we'll be watching very carefully, is the extent to which Mr. Mugabe still has influence over the electorate. Now, I suspect in certain, particularly Shona areas, he has more influence over how people vote than we might like to think, given his perfectly dreadful and really quite bloody career over the past, 30 or 40 years. Zimbabwe is a deeply tribal country, and Mr. Mugabe knows how to appeal to that.
The polls are unreliable, but they give Mr. Mnangagwa, the incumbent, just a slight lead. Does the opposition movement for democratic change have a chance in this election, in your view?
It has a chance, but remember, in Africa, in the 21st century, elections are stolen not at the polls, but rather where the results are all bought together. And, of course, Mr. Mnangagwa controls that process. So we will have to see.
Well, Mr. Chamisa did say that the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission is biased.
He did indeed. And I think the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission is indeed biased. It is a creation of the incumbent government. And in Africa, incumbent governments always have a huge advantage over challengers.
The government has allowed in welcome foreign media, international observers from the European Union, U.S., and the Commonwealth. Will this, do you think, make a difference?
Good question. I don't know. My basic view is that outside election observers don't see very much, that the people who do see tend to be the indigenous election observers. And the advantage that outside election observers provide is that it becomes much harder to beat up local election observers. So we'll have to see. But the people that I will be looking at are the local election observers. Do they find the process credible or not? That's what I want to know.
Is a September 8 runoff possible?
Yes, it is possible. Because there's so much that's unknown, yes, it's possible.
John Campbell, Senior Fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This is VOA's International Edition. Trump administration is giving an ultimatum to Turkey over an American evangelical Christian pastor it has held for more than a year now on terror and espionage charges. AP Sagar Magani is following the story.
Andrew Brunson's case has strained relations between the two NATO allies, and Vice President Mike Pence issued a warning during a religious freedom summit.
If Turkey does not take immediate action to free this innocent man of faith and send him home to America, the United States will impose significant sanctions.
President Trump later tweeted he will impose large sanctions if Brunson's not freed. Turkey's president has in the past linked Brunson's release to the U.S. extraditing a Pennsylvania cleric whom he holds responsible for a failed military coup 2 years ago. Sagar Magani, Washington.
And on Sunday, Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said his government would not back down and was willing to, in his words, go its own way if the United States imposes sanctions over the 50-year-old American pastor. VOA asked James Jeffrey, a distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and a former U.S. ambassador to Turkey, for his thoughts on all of this.
Some months ago, President Erdogan, who's interested in the extradition from Pennsylvania of Fethullah Gulen, who the Turks, I think with good reason, think was behind the 2016 coup, made a suggested publicly a linkage between Pastor Brunson and Fethullah Gulen. This latest development, however, came as a surprise because it was right after Pastor Brunson was released from prison. But I've done a lot of these things with Turkey. We have agreements. There is various ways. I've also watched how the Turks have negotiated things with the Germans and others. Typically, that would have been seen as a positive sign and an indication that things were moving the right way. And Secretary Pompeo initially gave it, I would say, you know, not total, but fairly good praise. He seemed to be pleased. Then the American side blew up. The Washington Post had a piece on Friday stating that it was, in fact, that there was a quid pro quo with a Turkish citizen, Ebru Özkan, in Israel, who had been trying to help Hamas, who had been arrested, and that she was released, although apparently she hasn't yet been legally acquitted. I'm not sure of that. And that this was some sort of trade, that the Americans had worked on that, and that the Turks didn't live up to their side. The problem is, both some U.S. officials and the Turkish side are seemingly questioning this, and the Turkish side is considering all of the accusations against them, has been relatively calm on this so far. I mean, Erdogan has to say something like this because the U.S. government is basically calling into question the whole judicial system in Turkey. And while you or I might have questions about it, you normally don't do this government to government. The other thing is, it obviously doesn't, it makes it very hard for the Turks to actually release this guy unless they want to be totally look like they're totally, dancing to the tune of Washington. So it puts it, it actually might make it harder for Pastor Brunson to get out. But I mean, I think there was progress, and I think something went badly wrong. But I've yet to get to the bottom of this, and I haven't seen anything in the media that is so far clear. Again, the Turks have done this repeatedly with Germany and other countries on not dissimilar cases. So the fact that they've done it with Europeans and this thing blew up suggests that perhaps the problem is on the U.S. side.
It's Ambassador James Jeffrey, a distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He's a former American ambassador to Turkey. You know, you can keep up to date on Pastor Andrew Brunson's detention there in Turkey at our website, voanews.com. Also in the news, just 100 days left now before the U.S. so-called midterm elections. That'll be in November. Control of both chambers of the U.S. Congress will be at stake. Polls give opposition Democrats right now an edge, and both parties agree that Republican President Donald Trump will be the key issue in this year's election. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more from our Washington News Center.
At a recent rally in Montana, President Trump urged his supporters to turn out in force to help Republican candidates in November.
We won't back down, we won't give in, and we will never, ever surrender. We will never, ever quit. We go forward to victory.
Opposition Democrats are also waging an intense grassroots campaign for the midterms. 2016 presidential contender Bernie Sanders rallied supporters in Kansas.
This fight about who controls the House is unbelievably important. It could literally come down to one or two elections. If you guys can do what I know you can, this will be an election heard not only all over this country, but all over the world.
Democrats need to pick up about two dozen seats to retake the majority in the House and gain two seats to have a majority in the Senate. In addition to being energized this year, Democrats should have history on their side, says John Fortier.
The midterms generally are good for the out party, the party out of the White House. And in this case, Donald Trump is a particularly unpopular president among Democrats. They are motivated. They don't like him. They want to come out to vote.
But Trump is urging his supporters to defy history and turn out to show support for his agenda. Both parties now see the midterms as a referendum on the president, says analyst Larry Sabato.
We've rarely had a president who was so centered on an election and so essential to it. He's the sun. Everything else revolving around the sun is a planet or a moon.
Given Trump's low approval rating and the past history of midterm results, Democrats should make gains, says Elaine Kamer.
I think the question is it a Democratic wave or is it a Democratic tsunami? Do Democrats take the House with, you know, a margin of 5 or do they take the House with a margin of 30? That I don't think anybody can tell yet.
But given the president's loyal base, Republicans could do better than expected, says former Trump campaign manager Corey Lewandowski.
I think the Democrats will gain some seats. But right now, if the election were held today, the Republicans may hold the House by one or two.
All 435 House seats and about a third of the 100 Senate seats are at stake in November. And the outcome will have a major impact on the next 2 years of Trump's presidency. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
And later in the program, the sounds of Wilson Pickett. Cambodians headed to the polls on Sunday for an election in which the only viable alternative party had been banned. Prime Minister Hun Sen's Cambodian People's Party took the ballot in a landslide following the dissolution of the opposition Cambodian National Rescue Party late last year. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke about the election with Sofal Ear. He's the Assistant Professor of Diplomacy and World Affairs at Occidental College.
We all expected this outcome given how the election was set up and how the ballot looked.
How did it look, and why is Hun Sen able to get away with this? What has transpired?
Well, the ballot did not include the main opposition, Cambodian National Rescue Party, which won 44% of the vote in 2013 and 43% in commune elections in 2017. And he's able to do that, the Prime Minister of Cambodia is able to do that because he has all the levers of government, including the judiciary, to launch attacks and to dissolve the main opposition party, which is what happened last year. What's happened over the last year has been a systematic effort to essentially dismantle the opposition, shutter the media, independent media that would have covered negative stories or things that the government would have done that would have been suspicious, and to essentially silence all critics. So even independent observers like the National Democratic Institute, which operated for many years in Cambodia, was expelled. Radio Free Asia hasn't been able to operate in Cambodia since that time. And so it's essentially going down a list of enemies that he's had that he needs to get rid of, and he got rid of them.
So what happens now?
The status quo of more of the same could continue. There is that possibility that he would still feel insecure and need to somehow further control conditions around him. I think there's also the possibility, frankly, that he might decide that having secured 5 years, it's time to look at transitions and perhaps moving one of his sons to become prime minister while he remains, of course, in the background as, say, minister mentor like Lee Kuan Yew was, or maybe taking the cue from Myanmar as a state counselor or something like that, as Aung San Suu Kyi is. But I think the idea here is that there's going to be obviously a need to look at transitions. And then there's also the very remote possibility that having gotten 90 possibly percent of the National Assembly seats, 90%, that they'll feel now able to clean up all the corruption that has made Cambodia a world leader in that area and certainly the most corrupt country in Southeast Asia.
So Paul Ear, an assistant professor of diplomacy, world affairs at Occidental College, speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
The Yellowstone supervolcano is thought to have had three major eruptions between 640,000 and 2.1 million years ago. It's been long thought that the volcano is powered by the heat from the Earth's core, like most other volcanoes. But a new study suggests that the volcanic eruptions at Yellowstone were instead caused by hot materials being pushed upward by a huge oceanic tectonic plate that jammed itself beneath the present-day western United States about 30 million years ago. Study author and Virginia Tech Associate Professor Ying Chow says that she did not find any proof of heat coming up from the Earth's core that could have powered the Yellowstone supervolcano. She did find an odd underground structure at about 322 to 645 kilometers beneath the line of volcanoes between Oregon, Idaho, and Wyoming. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Very good to have you with us today. It is time now for a little something from the world of music. Wilson Pickett is an American singer and songwriter, a major figure in the development of American soul music, with dozens of songs on the U.S. R&B charts, and many more crossing over to the Billboard Hot 100.
Yeah.
6-3-4-5-7-8-9 was a huge hit for Wilson Pickett, who was born in 1941 and grew up singing in church choirs. His forceful, passionate style of singing was developed in the church and under the influence of recording stars such as Little Richard, known widely as the architect of rock and roll. The tune Mustang Sally had a real rock and roll feel, and it was a super hit for Wilson Pickett. Mustang Sally. Guess you better slow your Mustang down. Oh, Lord. What I said now. Mustang Sally now, baby. Oh, Lord. Guess you better slow your Mustang down. Oh, yeah. You've been running. After singing for a number of years in a popular gospel harmony group, Pickett was lured by the success of other gospel singers of the day, including Sam Cooke, Aretha Franklin, and others, who left gospel music in the late 1950s for the more lucrative secular music market. Pickett made the move to chart-topping tunes like the ones he co-wrote with Eddie Floyd and Steve Cropper. Songs like the super hit In the Midnight Hour, considered a soul classic. Throughout the 1990s, despite his personal troubles, including a number of arrests for assaulting others, Wilson Pickett was repeatedly honored for his contributions to music. The father of six children, Wilson Pickett spent the twilight of his career playing dozens of concert dates every year until 2004, when he began suffering from health problems. While in the hospital, he returned to his spiritual roots and said he wanted to record a gospel album, but he never recovered. Pickett died of a heart attack on January 19, 2006, in Reston, Virginia, just outside of Washington. He was 64.
Yeah!
Another singing sensation out of the 1960s was a superstar himself. Neil Diamond sang, well, let me tell you, sang a lot of songs, but he gave another performance just in the last couple of days to the firefighters who were fighting a blaze near his house in the U.S. state of Colorado. 77-year-old Rock and Roll Hall of Famer took to the stage to play his big hit, Sweet Caroline, for the dozens of firefighters who had gathered at the command post there in central Colorado. A video of that event showed that Diamond went around. He thanked everybody for doing what they could for the community. And you might remember this made the news not long ago. Diamond abruptly retired from touring in January after he said he was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. As for that fire in Colorado, two people were accused of igniting the blaze on July the 3rd by firing an incendiary tracer round at a shooting range nearby. 51 square kilometer fires destroyed three homes. About 450 people are helping battle the blaze, which is, for the most part, just about contained. Listen, thanks everyone for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you here. The latest world news is straight ahead, so we hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, John Ellison, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a super Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
As Sierra Leone recovers from the Ebola epidemic of 2014 to 2016, the most widespread outbreak of the disease in history, the country's Ministry of Health and Sanitation is helping families to find the graves of those who perished. With support from the United States government through the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC, the ministry and its partners have launched the Sierra Leone Ebola Database Family Reunification Program. The SLED program, as it is known, is based on information recorded during the epidemic by thousands of Sierra Leonean surveillance officers, burial team members, laboratory technicians, and data managers. The SLED team of Sierra Leonean and CDC data managers was able to organize and collect more than 500,000 alerts, burial, and other patient records, creating the most complete collection of data from the Ebola epidemic. The primary objectives of SLED are not only to locate the graves of those who died during the epidemic, but also to create a resource for public health research by providing secure data access via the CDC Research Data Center. With CDC support, we are proud to have the most comprehensive imaging of all efforts around the Ebola epidemic in Sierra Leone, said Dr. Amara Jambai, Deputy Chief Medical Officer at the Ministry of Health and Sanitation. Dr. Tushar Singh, U.S. CDC Country Director, said that U.S. government support for the SLED project helps to advance relationship with the government of Sierra Leone and to create a resource for research capacity building and future epidemic prevention. In the 1970s, the CDC first began working in Sierra Leone researching Lassa fever. In 2008, the agency expanded its reach with the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, building laboratory and surveillance capacity. As part of the 2014 to 2016 Ebola response, more than 700 CDC staff served on over 1,000 deployments. It was CDC's largest outbreak response ever in a single country. In 2015, a permanent CDC country office was established in Sierra Leone to focus on global health security efforts. The United States is proud to work with public and private sector partners in Sierra Leone to protect the people of Sierra Leone as they recover from the ravages of the deadly Ebola epidemic.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.